Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do economic concepts like moral hazard, incentives, division of labor, and supply and demand have to do with a healthy relationship? It may sound less than romantic to think about managing marital satisfaction according to the same rules you apply to planning a budget or balancing a checkbook, but my guest today says the bottom line is that it can work to simplify or even solve the kinds of recurring everyday conflicts that plague many couples. Jenny Anderson has covered Wall Street and the Merrill Lynch scandal as a reporter for the New York Times. Her new book, written with Paula Schumann of the Wall Street Journal, is called Spousonomics: Using Economics to Master Love, Marriage, and Dirty Dishes. Jenny, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
Can you talk about how you and your co-author got to thinking about the economics of marriage?
Sure. It was 2007, and we were both newly married, and the financial world was falling apart, starting to fall apart all around us. Paula is a page one editor at the Wall Street Journal, and I, at the time, was covering Wall Street for the New York Times. So we were sort of mired in the day-to-day story, which was the financial collapse. And we started noticing a lot of parallels, again, sort of being newly married and being very interested in marriage as a topic and in relationships and how we were going to make this work. We're both quite individualistic type people, and suddenly here we were married, which is where we both wanted to be, and suddenly it seemed a little bit harder than we realized. We started drawing parallels between what was happening in the financial world and what was happening in our own lives. You know, moral hazard, a concept that it was being bandied about so much, the concept, you know, were banks taking reckless risks because they had insurance, effectively, which was Uncle Sam. Mm-hmm. You know, is marriage just a construct for moral hazard? Do we take our spouses for granted because we have insurance, which is each other, and incentives and trade-offs and even game theory, you know, strategizing to sort of get the best outcome. It all, there seemed to be something there, and so we started digging, and the more digging we did, the more we found that there were indeed there was more to it than we realized.
So what are the scarce resources of a marriage that need to be measured and ultimately managed?
Excellent question. I would say probably the scarcest resources we heard about, and we interviewed over 250 couples for this book, were time and energy. I mean, I think people are just really, really stretched thin today in terms of obviously a lot more women working. And so we've got, you know, two careers, kids. Kids' schedules just seem completely out of control at this point, yeah, in terms of the number of activities they do, and you know, trying to make it work with the two working parents. And so, time, energy, libido. You know, it's. I feel like every day is really, if you think about it, you really are trying to organize your lives, your professional lives, your children's lives, and allocate your time and energy toward those goals. And so that's what, when we talk about the, you know, economics is the efficient allocation of scarce resources. That's the economic definition in real life. It's really how you allocate your time and energy.
So let's go to division of labor. In 2011, when in a lot of marriages, both partners work outside the home, it seems only fair somehow that the chores around the house would be split 50-50. You don't actually think that's the best way to go about it?
We don't, and I will confess confess very readily that when I got married, that was absolutely, you know, my aspiration was 50-50. I mean, I couldn't even possibly conceive of it of any other way. Why would it be any other way? And then I got married and reality set in. And the point of comparative advantage, which is what we talk about in the book, is that it focuses on people's relative strengths and weaknesses, which incorporates that which they like to do. Now, of course, there's tasks that nobody likes to do. Who really likes to do dishes or clean toilets? But at the end of the day, dividing things 50-50 ultimately is a recipe for a lot of bickering because you have to keep score. Mm-hmm. There's just, we met a number of couples who had whiteboards, who had lists, who had spreadsheets, trying to keep track of sort of who was doing what, which is just in and of itself is a very time-consuming process. And if you think about every moment that you spend keeping track of that, that's less time that you could be actually doing something romantic or fun or, you know, constructive for your marriage. Then you maybe can start thinking about, is there a better system? And I think this really is a better system. It's a little bit hard to explain the math, but the bottom line is if there are a number of tasks, and you and I each do that which we are relatively better at vis-a-vis the other chores. So you basically take everything up and divide it up based on who's relatively better at what, and that's where you can get at the fairness. You know, you don't take 90% of the work and he gets 10%. You try to divide the tasks, but you figure out what each of you is relatively better at. And everybody is really relatively better at something, and there are enough chores to start dividing them up. And if you do, if you create a system that way, you effectively create time out of thin air. It's a very, it sounds crazy, but it's like a magical process because you're just, overall it takes less time. And so you free up a collective hour. You don't free up, one of you might not free up an hour, but the other might free up an hour. And but in the pool that is your marriage of work done, there is one less hour every week that's getting done. So, you know, maybe that works to your benefit now, and then maybe when things switch around in a couple of years, that'll work to his benefit. But the goal is over time, obviously, there's a balance and there's a sense of fairness. But on a day-to-day basis, a 50-50 system seems to be a recipe for more fighting and more bickering and more time spent trying to figure out who's doing what.
Yeah, it's funny because as I was reading your book this week, I observed this in my kids who are supposed to divide up who empties the dishwasher. Mm-hmm. And I listened, overheard them arguing for about half an hour over whose turn it was. And finally, my 11-year-old said, fine, I'm tired of arguing like an old married couple, you know. And he, But it occurred to me after reading the book that maybe that should be one person's job and somebody else will be only in charge of garbage or folding laundry or something.
Right. And then you can switch it up. It doesn't have to be that. I mean, it's funny, every chapter we do, we present three case studies to kind of show how this stuff works in real life. And in one of the, in the division of labor chapter, which deals with comparative advantage, one of the things we talk about is you can teach an old dog new tricks, or in your case, a young child. It is possible to switch up the tricks. You know, there was a couple where, you know, she always did the bills and he always did sort of the lawn work and whatever. And she sort of realized, I hate doing the bills. Mm-hmm. And he really didn't actually very much enjoyed it. He'd done, you know, he'd sort of done the yard work forever and found it a little bit tedious, and she wanted to spend more time outside, and he was a little bit, I think, embarrassed that he didn't know more about his own family's finances, and so they switched, and then, you know, there's a sticky period where it's not that comfortable, where she had to sort of look over his shoulders to make sure he was understanding the software and, you know, doing the bills right, and, you know, he wasn't all too happy, perhaps, with the initial few weeks of the lawn work, but, you know, eventually you can switch it up. So it's not, we're not saying that this is a recipe for, okay, you're relatively better at the dishes. You will do dishes for the rest of your life. You know, you can switch it up. You can learn new tasks.
So let me ask you this. In most families, somebody has to mow the lawn and somebody has to do the dishes, or you can't really get by over time. What about those chores that are maybe non-essential to one partner but really important to another? Like in some couples, one person really needs the bed made every day.
Right. So then you have to, that's where you get into the art of negotiation more than you do comparative advantage, because you have to decide which are the tasks that you collectively care about and who cares about, you know, I can't tell you the number of times we heard the complaint, you know, I'm more than happy to do the dishes, but I'm sick of her complaining that I don't do them to the same standard.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that becomes a, something in game theory called strategic polarization, where the issue is, you know, are you becoming polarized over the issue because you're just mad about it? In other words, are you saying they have to be spotless and he's saying they're going to be completely dirty, you know, or this is the best I can do, just because you're sort of angry at each other and you're sort of, you know, steaming about it? And rather than just saying, you know what, maybe if he's doing the dishes and he's doing a pretty good job, you're just going to have to accept that that's the job that's going to get done. And, you know, she's going to have to factor in that, you know, she's got higher standards for certain things. I mean, that's sort of marriage, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there is a lot of compromise that goes into it. So I think you can put math on the overall sort of allocation of labor, but there are going to be certain tasks that one person cares more about, and then you factor that in. You know, you factor in if I'm, and we also found that when you are relatively better at a task, you tend to be faster at it, and you tend to be faster and better at the things you care more about, right? So when you're good at something, or when you really want something done, you tend to get faster at it.
So let me ask you this. One of the most repeated pieces of timeless marital advice is never go to bed angry. And I don't know too many couples, including very happily married people, who haven't gone to bed angry on occasion. You think it's actually okay in many cases?
I think it's a really good idea, actually. And again, another one of those things that I never would have I would have thought it was, you know, hearsay before I started writing this book. But there's a concept in economics called loss aversion, and it means just that. We hate to lose. And you think, well, what's more obvious than that? Who cares? But economists have done some really interesting research that have actually documented how much we hate to lose. We basically hate to lose twice as much as we like to win. We have to win $200 to make up for the loss of $100. And what that translates to in some of the studies that the economists looked at is, for example, traders, when they're down, start making more and more irrational bets. They basically bet the house, which, you know, any smart stock trader would tell you is never the way you want to go from a risk management standpoint.
Sure.
It can turn out very, very badly. And it's true of human beings as well, who aren't stock traders. In the face of losses, we act very irrationally. And when we're fighting with our spouses, we often feel like we're losing. You know, it's an in the moment thing, but we do. And so we start acting a little bit more irrationally. And so what we're saying is, it's sometimes better to take a time out if you're in the middle of a fight. And we have some great statistics on this. 53% of people keep arguing after they start repeating themselves. 34% of people keep fighting after they can't remember what they were originally fighting about. 34% of people keep fighting after they know they're wrong. So we know, clearly we're acting irrationally. You know, if you can't even remember what you're arguing about, but you're still arguing, something has gone, you know, something's gone on the fritz.
You've got diminishing returns, certainly, at that point.
Exactly. So I think the point is, take a time out, go to sleep, even if you're angry, see how you feel in the morning. And in the morning, if you're still upset about the issue, I think you have to readdress it. I mean, it's like, don't get through weeks. Silent treatment isn't the answer, and
right,
not talking about issues isn't the answer. But having an argument when you're really, really emotional is also not the answer. And so that timeout allows you to sort of assess what you care about and what you don't. And I have certainly found that, and this is a very hard lesson for me to learn, I go to bed angry. There are mornings where I can't even remember what it was we were fighting about. You know, you sort of wake up in the morning and you're kind of on to the next set of issues.
Mm-hmm.
And you're thinking, oh my God, I was so mad last night about whatever, some bills that didn't get paid. And you get up in the morning and you're on to the next things. And suddenly at the end of the day, you realize, oh my gosh, the bills got paid. Like, why was I so mad about it in that moment? Because it sort of triggers other things in you, right?
And yeah.
So it's setting a little bit of that aside, I think.
What about those cases where, you know, we're so angry and we forget that we're supposed to be on the same team? You know what I mean? Like.
Oh, absolutely. That again, well, that's in game theory, that's strategic polarization. It's like you start off kind of a centimeter away from each other. And just because it's something that, it's very irrational, right? It triggers something in us that makes us feel like we need to kind of defend our position more than it is recognize that, you know, a compromise would be the easiest solution. Some of that's, and economists study this a lot, it's called reputation building, right? You know, if you have, you don't want to, you basically don't want to risk being the sucker, right? So if you give in now, does that mean that he's going to think you're going to give in forever? We saw this a lot with real estate searches, which seems to cause a lot of tension in a lot of marriages and in a lot of relationships, period. Just, you know, you start off thinking, okay, well, maybe one person wants a slightly nicer neighborhood and a slightly smaller house, another person wants the other or whatever. And, you know, as time goes on and you look at more places, it becomes, you know, he wants to live in Beverly Hills in, like, the nicest place possible, and she wants to live in, like, Crown Heights. You know, it's like you just sort of start a centimeter away from each other and you end up a mile away from each other.
Jenny Anderson is my guest. She's a reporter for The New York Times who has covered Wall Street and the Merrill Lynch scandal. Her new book, written with Paula Schumann of The Wall Street Journal, is called Spousonomics: Using Economics to Master Love, Marriage, and Dirty Dishes. We would love for you to participate in this conversation. You can call us now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is New York Times reporter Jenny Anderson. Her new book, written with Paula Schumann of The Wall Street Journal, is called Spousenomics: Using Economics to Master Love, Marriage, and Dirty Dishes. Join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. So it seems, Jenny, that in a lot of marriages, there is one person who thinks, has different ideas about how much sex is an appropriate amount of sex to be having. If one person wants more, you suggest essentially removing the costs of those encounters.
We do. Again, this is so the basic tenet from economics. We'll start there, and then I'll talk about some of the couples we met and talked to, as well as some of the marriage counselors who had some interesting thoughts on this as well. The basis in economics is simply the laws of supply and demand. The more something costs, the less you tend to want of it. That is held pretty firm over time. And so we went out there and we did this professional survey and asked people a ton of questions about their sex lives. And it was remarkable how much people seemed to be saying they wanted to have more sex, but they weren't doing it. So it was sort of, 77% of people said, agreed with the statement, the amount of sex diminishes over time in marriage. And then 76% of people said it shouldn't be the case that the amount of sex diminishes over time. And so, of course, the logical question is, well, you people are the ones who are married. you don't have to go out and win the girl or the guy. They're right there. So what's going on? And so we asked people, why aren't you having sex? And the number one reason was they were too tired. I think this goes back to the original issue we were talking about, which is people are stretched really thin. And so the question becomes, how do we make it easier for ourselves to have sex? And I think one of the problems we heard over and over again was, a while goes by, we haven't had sex, and you start thinking about, it sort of becomes costly in your own mind, again, in terms of time and energy.
Mm-hmm.
You want it to be good. You want it to be not just sort of mundane, run-of-the-mill Wednesday night sex. You want it to be romantic sex. You want it to be great sex. And so it becomes sort of more costly in your mind because you're waiting for maybe an hour-long chunk of time that you're going to have in your schedule, and when that doesn't materialize, it doesn't happen, and then, of course, it gets even bigger in your mind, right?
Yeah.
Oh, we've got to do this. It's got to be great. And the couples we met who were sort of making it easier for themselves, recognizing the reality of their schedules, and then in some cases actually scheduling it, but in just more sort of dealing with the reality of life. So we met one couple who sort of spent a lot of time talking about why they weren't having sex, which was hysterical because they were like, at one point we realized the amount of time we spent talking about why we weren't having sex could have actually been really well used having sex. But they realized that what they were doing was they sort of got home from work, they had dinner, they got their kids to bed, oftentimes they had dinner themselves, and then they would sit down at their computers and do a little bit more work or, Blackberries or whatever it was, and then they got in bed and it was like catatonic at that point. They were completely wiped out. And they sort of said, wait a second, there's a couple windows in there that might work better. Like, after the kids go to sleep, but before we have dinner, they had young kids, mind you, after we put the kids to bed, but before we have dinner, like, we're motivated by hunger, we're not completely catatonic, and we're not stressed about work, because once you start kind of getting, they knew they had to go back and work, and then after work, they were never in the mood. So, again, this worked for them, and I think the point was they were lowering the cost for themselves, and they also decided to just stop talking about the fact that they weren't having sex.
Mm-hmm.
They said, instead of starting the conversation, let's just, every time we start that conversation, perhaps we should be actually doing it. And, people were creative with other ways they did it. Another theme we heard over and over again was, as you said, there's usually one person who wants it more than the others. And I don't think it actually follows gender stereotypes. We talked to a lot of women who said, they felt like they weren't getting enough sex in their marriages. And one of the things we found is the person who wants it more over time gets reluctant to ask because they don't want to feel rejected.
Mm-hmm.
And so some couples we talked to had come up with some really creative sort of signals, ways of communicating without having to put yourself out there every time. And I know this is your spouse, and you should be able to do that. But sometimes you just don't want to. Like, rejection stinks any way you cut it, even with your spouse.
Yeah, so you eliminate the guesswork, essentially.
Eliminate the guesswork. So it was a really sweet couple who'd actually been married a really long time. I mean, they'd been married 30-some years. It was an older couple, and she joked that, he got turned on basically, closing a door. And that had just never really been her thing. And but he was always frustrated because he was asking and she was refusing. And she basically said to him one day, okay, the way we can fix this is I need to feel like I'm initiating it every once in a while. but I don't want to have a conversation about it. And so they sort of came up with signals. I mean, it was a cup of tea in their case. Like Saturday morning, she would get out of bed, take a shower, come back with her cup of tea, and that was sort of their signal. Mm-hmm. And for him, his signal was he was not a particularly romantic guy, and she sort of complained that she wanted a little more romance. So she joked that, when he poured a glass of wine after dinner or lit a fire or, maybe brought up that he wanted to read a poem or took her out on a nice date, like that was sort of his signal that he'd thought about something that she might want to do, because she said if it was up to him, he'd stay home and play Scrabble every night. So, when he was putting that effort in, that was sort of his signal, and he learned that he couldn't do it every night, right? And so they sort of came up with a system that eliminated the need to have the conversation all the time. So I think couples really come up with creative solutions, but the goal was, and I love this, someone once said this to us, some mediocre sex is better than no amazing sex. And I think that that's really true. I think that a lot of us are waiting because, oftentimes you start out and it is amazing. That's like part of why you married the person, right? I'm sure there were 1,000 other reasons, but, sometimes that's a big foundation, and then as that diminishes, that's your goal. You're sort of trying to get back to that goal, right? And so you're sitting there thinking, oh, we want to have sex, but we don't want to have, bored, married Wednesday night sex. We want to have, newly married, crazy sex. And then it never happens.
Yeah, well, what's so refreshing about this advice is that, you look in a lot of places and they talk about, spending 45 minutes lighting candles and shaving your legs, and you're right, that's exhausting before you even get to the bedroom.
Right, and let's face it, whoever regrets having sex once you've had it, right? Like once you've had it, it's like going running. I mean, it might be horrible thinking about doing it, it's cold, and you don't want to do it, and you're tired, and you'd rather sleep for 20 minutes, but then you do it, and you're like, oh, that was great.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Joyce in Cedar Hill now. Hi, Joyce.
Hi. I wanted to mention that I am researching details for at least writing an article on what she's talking about, because I've had an economically based 40-year marriage that my husband decided he needs to end because there are some factors that she hasn't even mentioned. It has to be deeper than just the economics. I did a T-chart and measured his assets and liabilities, not his cuteness, but his brain, his ethics, his character, all kinds of things that I observed when I was 19 and cost justified the overhead of a husband, and have measured our lives in economic terms, even where we live and everything else. And I'm the analytical measuring person. He's the emotional with writing poetry person. And what we find after 40 years, according to him, is he's just regressed to the family lifestyle he had and his values versus what we've built as a couple.
Any thoughts about that, Jenny?
I didn't actually hear the very last part. You said he regrets the life that you guys have built together?
I guess back to the life that he had when he was a kid. Is that what he wants?
He's reversed into, regressed back into what his original family was like.
Uh-huh.
As he's gotten older. He
right.
wants to be more like his original family versus what we've built for 40 years.
Right. Well, it sounds like there's some pretty deep psychological issues going on there. And, I mean, one of the things we definitely say with this book is that, at a certain point, this is a book that's about sort of trying to bicker a little bit less and try to get at. And then when you're talking about issues from childhood, and I don't know what his issues, particular issues are, but those can be very complicated. But there is a concept that sort of rings a bell from what you're saying in economics called sunk costs. And when people are making an evaluation of their lives, they have to decide whether what they've already invested is worth carrying forward. In other words, a lot of times we invest a lot into something, and then it doesn't make sense for us. That's not a justification in and of itself to carry it forward. I mean, it's very sad because it sounds like to you it might be and to him it isn't, and I don't know why that is. And, it sounds like a horrible situation, but economists would certainly say, at a certain point you shouldn't only do something because you've already done it effectively. You shouldn't stay married just because you've gotten married. You need to stay married because you feel like the future cost, benefits are going to outweigh the costs. And it sounds like for whatever reason, and I don't know what those are, he doesn't want to do that. And it sounds like a very sad situation. I'm so sorry.
And I guess when you're doing a cost-benefit analysis, you and your partner are the only people who know which factors really count. Am I right about that?
Absolutely, absolutely. And again, I think you want, and you know, psychologists do this, economists can do this. Other people can offer you frameworks in which to try to think through the issues, and I think that's part of the problem. Sometimes we get caught in sort of feedback loops and, again, sort of repeating ourselves, or we react a way that we've always reacted, and I think that's what's so dangerous, right? Sometimes we need to sort of break that loop to see if there's not a better solution, which isn't to say maybe you come to the same end, which in some cases might end up being divorce or separation. But I think what a lot of what we're trying to accomplish in this book is trying to help people kind of have a few more tools at their fingertips mm-hmm. when they're thinking through these issues, like housework, like allocating their time, like sex. You know, I mean, these are just, I think these are or finances, you know. Money issues are obviously very critical to people, and I think sometimes we act the way we do because that's either the way we've always acted or that's the only way we know to act, but there are other alternatives, and maybe offering people some alternative solutions through seeing what other couples do can be helpful.
Going back, Jenny, to the game theory section of the book, you know, there's all this research that shows that most couples, even those who stay married, have the same fights over and over and over, that they have the first year that they're often having the same fights over smaller things, you know, 30 years later. And one of the things you say is at some point, if what you've been trying to fix something hasn't worked, you have to change the game.
Right. Right. So you see that I think that sort of it's the feedback loop issue, right? I mean, it's almost like you guys are on repeat. You're having the same argument over and over again, and yet you need to find a different way to have it. So, you know, I feel like I almost need an example to fix, but I definitely do think that I'm trying to think of a good one. One was we knew a couple that was arguing about kitty litter. I mean, they've been having the same argument for kitty litter, like who changed the kitty litter, and they're always arguing who was changing it more. And they finally devised, actually on the advice of my co-author, they devised a system by which the person who got up in the morning, first person who got up in the morning, had to change the kitty litter, had to make the coffee, but that person got to go to the gym that day.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, again, a family who had young kids, and that gym time was quite precious. So there was a positive incentive in place to do a task that neither one of them wanted to do. And it also sort of knocked off one other task, which was the coffee, because it was like, if you're going to get up and change the kitty litter, you might as well make the coffee.
Yeah.
So there you go. You've taken care of two tasks that had been bickered about for a long time, and there was a positive reward to it. Now, that sounds a little bit like training rats or, you know, training dogs, but it worked for them. And I do think that sometimes that's the remarkable thing. It can sometimes be very small changes to perpetual fights or perpetual issues that can break the cycle.
New York Times reporter Jenny Anderson is my guest. Her new book is called Spousenomics. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next on the line to Carol in Denton. Hi, Carol.
Hi there. First of all, I want to thank you for shedding a light on this information. It's just appreciated very much. This is Lifeport Public Radio. It's changing my life and opening my eyes.
Well, good. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. I feel like in my marriage that I'm on the right track. We do some of these things that you've mentioned. This is why I pulled over to call, is that, you know, if the dishes need to be done, whoever has the time, whoever's available does the dishes. I pretty much always do that because I can stand in the middle of the kitchen and watch all the kids and, you know, keep everybody on task and everything. He cooks because he's really good at that, and that's where he really does his thing. And it just really, really, that encourages me that maybe we're on the right track. So this feels like a tool that I could use to get this book and see, you know, kind of what else I can amp it up a little bit. My question is, we're a hybrid family, the new, you know, he was a 40-something bachelor always. I was a single mom. We come together, and, you know, we come at it, I think, a lot different than if we'd have raised children together, of course. My question is addressing that. Sometimes we end up running the family more like a business. We kind of negotiate, or we kind of, you know, we're thinking too much about it, I think. Do you cover any of that kind of things in the book?
What do you think, Jenny?
Well, it's an interesting question, because normally a lot of people have criticized us and said, God, this is also, you know, sort of anti-romantic, and how could you possibly think of marriage this way? And what we've always said is, by trying to take care of some of the business of marriage, and I think anyone who's been married recognizes that there is a business of being married. There just is a lot of work that has to get done. Our argument has been, by doing that sort of more efficiently, you can get to the romance. But it sounds to me like what you're saying is, once you get there, you guys sort of aren't either sure what to do, or you haven't been able to get there. Which do you think it is?
Let's see. Carol, are you still on the line?
Other.
I'm sorry, Carol, say that again.
Go ahead. Oh, we're still very attracted to each other. We have five children. therefore right. time.
Yeah, I was going to say. So to me, my guess is you just don't, you know, there's probably not enough hours in the day. I mean, five kids, that's just an enormous amount of work. So it seems like to me, probably the biggest issue is actually really physically finding some time to spend together, just as the two of you, and that's going to be hard. You're going to need a family member who can actually be charged with five kids. That's almost impossible. But it seems to me that if you're still really attracted to each other, then it's just a matter of actually finding some physical time to be together. So without the children, because you know, they are sort of their own energy and their own dynamic once they're part of it. But again, I think what you're saying is you're still attracted to your spouse. You guys just have so much to do that there's no time. So the solution seems to be in some form, you know, is family members, neighbors, getting rid of those kids for just maybe 1 hour every week so you guys could just have some solo time to try to rekindle that romance and, you know, have a conversation, maybe have one glass of wine together and you know, promise that you're not going to talk about your five kids for 1 hour and, you know, I don't know, do something fun, have sex.
And sometimes, I guess, according to the book, it's about literally scheduling that time as if it's a commitment to go to the dentist or you know, go to a work meeting.
I know, and it can sound, and again, in and of itself, that sounds so completely unromantic, but once you get that hour, it will not feel that way, I promise you. I remember when my second baby was born, sort of arranging, you know, all these people, someone to take my older daughter to work and someone to take the baby, so that we could, we kind of knew what was in front of us. I mean, five kids, wow, that's Herculean, but we sort of knew that the next 6 months were going to be hard, right? They were going to be sleepless nights, we decided to schedule a morning to go for a long walk, have a cup of coffee, read the paper. That's what we needed sort of as a deep breath, like I out of the hospital before everything started, and we just said we need those 3 hours as a sort of energizing, kick us off, and we didn't talk about anything. You know, we didn't talk about the labor, we just sort of read the paper, enjoyed ourselves, relaxed, enjoyed each other's company, and that was sort of fuel to keep us going for the next 2 months, and then you know, we had a really bad by one of...
Let me stop you right there. We need to take a quick break. Jenny right. Anderson is my guest. Her new book is called Spousenomics. Join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is New York Times reporter Jenny Anderson. Her new book, written with Paula Schumann of The Wall Street Journal, is called Spousenomics, Using Economics to Master Love, Marriage, and Dirty Dishes. Our email address is think@kera.org. Phone number is 1-800-933-5372. Before the break, Jenny, you were saying that you and your husband scheduled a time that you could take a long walk and have some coffee together.
And I think I was going to finish that thought by saying it sounds depressing, but you know what? It will not feel depressing when you get to that hour or 2 or 3 hours that you've set aside. Laura Vanderkam, an author, just did a book called 168 Hours, and she was basically saying if we took the money that we put into our weddings and we used it, you know, over the first 5 years of our marriage to pay for babysitting. Many more people would stay married.
Well, you know what's so interesting about people who fear that this is somehow too calculating? You know, our great grandparents who you know had their own issues certainly with the way that division of labor was undertaken, they wouldn't have been surprised at all that you have to look at marriage at least in part as a business partnership, and that it takes work to sort of figure these things out. Do you think our notion these days that it should be all romantic and that it should happen so naturally, like it's like we expect our marriages to be the equivalent of like that genius kid who never has to study when most of us have to study?
Exactly. I mean, I think it's very unrealistic, and it would be so useful if we went in with realistic expectations because then we wouldn't be so horribly disappointed. I mean, I don't think this has to mean there isn't romance and there isn't love, but we don't get married out of economic necessity anymore. The world has changed tremendously. We get married because we want to be together. I mean, it's the consumption now is each other. Mm-hmm. Effectively, if you think we're not consuming, you know, goods and services, we've got a lifetime that you have to continue sort of every day choosing to be together. But if you think about it as, you know, again, labor and leisure, right? There's the labor of love, and then there's the leisure of love. And there's that really is how I think a lot of married couples with children look at it, and maybe some with regret and some with disappointment. But I don't know. I think if you could go into it thinking this is going to be a lot of hard work, and we're going to have to change our expectations as we go along. You know, a definition of a perfect Saturday is going to change from, you know, an hour in the morning to exercise, read the paper, sleep until noon, you know, go out for a nice boozy lunch. You know, it's going to change to, gosh, if we could get 20 minutes to ourselves in each, that would be phenomenal. And maybe even a date once a month, you know, just if you can change those expectations together, or at least maybe go in with some more realistic ones, that would be more effective.
We have an email here from Miguel who wanted to know if this is all equally applicable to same-sex relationships. I know from reading the book that you did talk to plenty of same-sex couples. Was there any major difference?
I think there were a lot of differences, and I would love to talk to more. I would say we talked to some, but not enough that I felt like I could draw some of the same conclusions as mm-hmm. I could about heterosexual couples. Certainly, a lot of the gay couples we talked to, women had issues about labor associated with kind of stereotypes of mommyhood. So the one who was the carrier of the baby had issues that were very different from the woman who was then the sort of quote unquote father. So there were those, and I would consider those very particular to gay couples. And then there were a lot of issues around not actually being able to get married in some states. So that was just what the commitment meant, and how they as a couple could actualize that commitment seemed to be something that caused a lot of tension. But, you know, these are human issues. I mean, these are absolutely apply to everyone. But again, we saw enough differences that I think we didn't want to represent something that we didn't feel like we could. That makes sense.
Yeah. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Susan in Dallas. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I have to tell you first, Chris, how much I enjoy your show. In fact, I take my lunch hour every day during your show and just sit in my car and run down the battery.
It's so sweet.
Heat, I'm in my car listening to your show. But I love this program, and I have to comment. My daughter and son-in-law have come to what I consider a brilliant solution. They're both decision makers, and they're so exhausted at the end of the week, nobody could decide what to do on the weekend. Mm-hmm. And they never got anything done. And so finally they decided, well, on Saturday she would make the decisions, and on Sunday he would make the decisions.
What a brilliant solution.
Which is, right, it's so simple. It's so obvious. And, I mean, you know, if one of them decides they're going to clean house, then they're both going to clean house. And if one of them decides they're going to a movie, then they're going to go to a movie. And that one makes a decision and the other's brain gets to turn off all day long.
I'm going to have to write that one down, Susan. Thank you so much for calling.
There is my true pleasure. Genius in that plan.
Yeah, it is sometimes, especially when you have kids. There's just, you know, having to answer 75 questions can be exhausting in and of itself.
Right, right. Or what parent hasn't gotten the, why don't you decide this, or why don't you do this? You're sort of better at it. It's like, wait a second, I don't want to make all the decisions here.
Right. It's the go ask your dad, go ask your mom conundrum.
I don't know the answer.
Let's go back to the phones now. Actually, we will not go to the phones. We have an email here from George who writes, you have to admit that this sometimes does not work. She will dress up for her friends to go out, but not on a date with me, or spend time chatting on the internet with her friends. When I ask for quality time, the response is, you have me. I think more women get compliance in marriage. What do you think about that? Are women in more control of how marriages go than men?
Oh, I don't think that's true at all. I'm sure if you asked each of the sexes, they would each say that the other, right? I mean, I think there is a sense. It's one of the hardest parts about being married, right, is that you feel like you've lost some of your autonomy. And I think that can be frustrating. And perhaps men feel it more because they need to exercise it more. I have no basis on saying that, you know, other than having talked to a lot of couples. And maybe there's a sense that he feels it more. But I think he's hitting on an incredibly important point, which is, you know, why do we sometimes invest more in our friends, or, you know, we talk to our colleagues at work with a particular tone of voice, and we would never dream of employing some of the tones of voices we use at home, right? Because those are professional relationships, and he's really getting at the moral hazard issue.
Yeah,
I believe, and it's she's got to sort of invest. I mean, I think she probably needs to realize that he's not there forever if she doesn't turn things around, right? I mean, the bottom line is no marriage is too big to fail. By spending more time with her friends and not putting a little bit of effort into some time you're going to spend with your husband, you know, that's sending a very powerful signal that this is not important to me.
And it does, the little tiny things do add up over time.
There's a concept called thinking at the margin, mm-hmm. which is we introduce in a chapter about trade-offs. And when weighing trade-offs and doing sort of cost-benefit analyses, there are decision-making biases that we make. And one is always thinking that the big solution is the right solution. So the example I would offer is my infant was sick over Christmas. I'm not kidding. She was sick for the entire month of December. And then my two-year-old got sick. I mean, we were just having a horrible month, right? Yeah. Everybody was sick, and we couldn't get out of the house, and our Christmas plans were canceled. And I kept making these pronouncements. We're leaving Manhattan. You know, we're never letting our kids play with any other kids again. You know, and it was like that in my very tired mind. That felt like the only solution. Honestly, and at one point, my husband looked at me and he was like, you know what we really need? We need to get a nurse to babysit for the night because our daughter was sick enough that we really just didn't feel like we could leave her with anyone, but we were suffocating. We were so tired.
Yeah.
Sick of dealing with all these issues. He's like, let's hire someone who's CPR trained, leave for 2 hours, and we will feel better. And we didn't. That's called thinking at the margin, thinking of small things, weighing the impact of incremental change. My guess is if Miguel's wife or partner, you know, got dressed up for one date, he would feel great. You know, it would be such a small gesture on her part to really make him realize that he was still very important to her, which he probably is.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next up, we have Michael in Dallas. Hello, Michael.
Hi.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
First time to call.
Welcome.
I just wanted to share an experience. Me and my wife have been married for about a year and a half now. And when we first got married, we sort of divvied up the chores, including the dirty dishes, and the laundry was the other big one. And we decided to do it on how we felt towards those chores. I hated doing the dishes. She hated unloading the dishwasher. She hated folding laundry, but I'd often mess something up if I put the laundry in. we ended up splitting it up where I would unload the dishwasher and fold the laundry, and she'd do the front end. And that worked for a little while, but we'd often find ourselves in conflicts because one or the other of us would be always waiting on the other half of the chore to get done. So about a year into our marriage, we decided this wasn't working very well, so we just bit the bullet. She decided she'd put up with folding the laundry, and I'd put up with doing the dishes in order for us both to resolve those conflicts over the little tiny chores. And
well, Mike, so it's working okay for you now?
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your call. It almost sounds, Jenny, like rebalancing a portfolio.
Exactly. I was going to say, it sounds like what you guys have going for you is that you see the problem, you know, you basically devise a system, you saw the problems in the system, and you fix the system. And my guess is, you know, you said you've been married for a year and a half. My guess is you'll reassess the system in 3 years and 5 years, and, you know, because it will change as the work of your lives change. Maybe one of you will get another job. Maybe one of you will take some time off. Maybe kids will be in the equation. Maybe sick parents will be in the equation. So, you know, these things completely change over time. Economies are incredibly dynamic, and so are relationships.
What's the value of occasionally outsourcing so that if you really can't agree on who's going to clean the toilets and wash the floors, you hire someone to come in and do it for you?
That's brilliant. You know, I mean, I'd outsource everything if I could. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there are economic considerations that go into that. But if you can afford it, I mean, geez, I think anyone with who's had some help cleaning the house would argue that it's a huge burden removed. It's no one has to discuss it because someone else is doing it for you. So I think if you can afford it, it's a great solution. Also with kids, you know, babysitting is a wonderful thing. It gives you time to actually reconnect with one another, talk to each other without having someone tugging on you or demanding something of you. You know, it's a remarkable thing to be able to have some time to enjoy each other again.
What was it like, Jenny, for you and for Paula, your co-author, as relatively recently married people, to go around and talk to these 200-plus couples about the intimacy of their marriage? Was it comforting? Was it scary thinking, oh, my God, 10 years from now, this could be happening? What did that feel like?
It was sort of amazing. I mean, I think there was a real, I would say there's two almost contradictory but probably complementary things that I observed. One was we all have the same issues,
mm-hmm.
You know, and a lot of them are perpetual issues. Just, again, me being married presents challenges, living with the same person for the rest of your life. Some of the issues really don't change that much. But being married over time, I definitely recognized that people cared about a lot of the smaller things from early on in marriage a lot less. And so, you know, I remember interviewing a woman who had a son with autism, and the issue she had was her husband literally couldn't deal with having a disabled child and the stress that had put on their marriage. And you sort of think, wow, that certainly puts dishes in perspective because it was such a, you know, more significant issue. Or when I was writing this chapter on loss aversion, or we were researching loss aversion and talking about that with my mother, my mom said, "You mean self-censorship? You actually have to write in a book that self-censorship is a good thing." And I was like, "Honestly, Mom, there are a lot of people out there who think you should say everything and say it in the moment it comes to your mind." And she was like, "God, my marriage would have been completely done in if I had done that." You know, of course you have to learn to self-edit. And of course you have, you know, if you love a person, you protect them a little bit.
Yeah, no.
So we saw both of that. I was almost always incredibly touched to hear, like, all the couples who'd been married for a really long time, even if they've been through horrible, horrible things, they, you know, they tended to say it was the horrible periods of their marriage that made them the strongest. Always true of economies as well, right?
Does this all apply to the fact that, you know, so many couples say that the one thing they fight the most about is how to spend their money?
Yes, we definitely found that one of the of the issues that people fight about, sex, money, housework, kids, in-laws, those definitely were the top
four issues. Horses of the apocalypse.
Exactly, as John Gottman would
Horseman.
Say. And I think we don't deal with money as its own issue. We deal with money as how you talk about it. And so I think the most at work with money is loss aversion, because I do think when couples tend to talk about money, if they don't have the same values toward it, it becomes an attack thing. You're a spender, you're a hoarder, you're a... You know, you sort of fit into these categories, and it's a perpetual issue. I think one of the most compelling things I saw from the economics was there's something in called commitment devices, which are things we put in place, recognizing we have particular behaviors, which is, of course, always the first step, acknowledgement. So perhaps I'm an overspender. We have to put in place a commitment device to help me do that which I want to do, but I never get around to doing.
Got to stop you there because we're out of time. Jenny Anderson has covered Wall Street and the Merrill Lynch scandal for the New York Times. Her new book, written with Paula Schumann, is called Spousonomics: Using Economics to Master Love, Marriage, and Dirty Dishes. Jenny, it's been really interesting. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.